Ladies and gentlemen, you are all very welcome to the Guild of Pastoral Psychology's talk, Synchronicity and Humility. The panellists today are Yoram Inspector, the speaker, Jim Keeling, Chair of the Guild of Pastoral Psychology, Julia Bevan, who is your moderator. I'm Toby Sims, your host, and I will now hand over to Jim Keeling.
Thank you very much, Toby. Well, welcome everyone. It's very exciting for us to do this because I know we're in for a treat, and a challenging treat from Yoram, who incidentally, it's the second time he's talked for the Guild, and I can very much recommend his first talk, which was on working in the psychosomatic field, a Jungian approach. Dr. Yoram Inspector works full-time as a consultant in the NHS. He is both a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist and is head of the psychological medicine unit at St. Mark's Hospital, London, which provides psychological treatment and support for people who have to cope with various gastrointestinal diseases and disorders. So he's a very busy man, and we're very lucky to have him. Yoram is a great believer in the healing powers of common sense and a good sense of humour. And I just do remember from his first talk, of course, having a name like Inspector gets you into all sorts of hot water, because are you a consultant or are you an inspector? So that's always my first question to you, Yoram.
Yeah, so thank you, Jim, for your presentation. Actually, Inspector is my real surname. Didn't change it, and maybe should be changed to Introspector, you know, if you're a psychotherapy. But probably one of my ancestors in Ukraine was an inspector of some sort, probably of kosher food, if I will relate to my Jewish origins. But I must say that I had one episode in my psychiatric training where I did a good use of my surname. I was treating an anorectic patient that used to steal money from her parents as part of acting out and escalating attention. And we sat in a family setting meeting, and the father looked at me fiercely and says, "Enough is enough. We know that she steals the money from us. We want you to tell us now, does she do it or not? Does she steal the money, yes or no?" And I don't know how I got myself off the hook and said, "I'm sorry, I'm here in the role of the doctor, not in the role of the inspector."
Ah, very good, very good.
That's right. So
good, Yoram. So anyway, so sorry about that. So we very much look forward to hearing you on synchronicity and humility.
Thank you for the warm invitation. This topic of synchronicity is a work in progress. And I must say, I found myself more and more aware of it and seeing it in my clinical work in the last years. And when I was asked, "Why do you think it's happening more?" without thinking, I said, "It's about love." And I think I'll touch upon it. Obviously, there are explanations from quantum physics and so on, but I think love has much to do with it. And I think it happens more when you're open. And this is just an intuitive thought. And when I was invited to this series of talk of humility, I immediately thought about synchronicity, because synchronicity really humbles you. And I'll try to demonstrate that. If I may, just dedicate this talk to one of my mentors, Bracha Geoni. This is a painting of her that was painted by another mentor of me, Ilan Kutz, who is an Israeli psychiatrist who was my supervisor on the heart transplantation research. And she was a psychoanalyst and the head of child and adolescent mental health center where I was trained, which was called Shalvata in Israel, that interestingly, the director of the center was Micha Neumann, who was the son of Erich Neumann. He interestingly embarked on a psychoanalytic training, and not a Jungian one, but he was very open. And Bracha was a psychoanalyst with a very, very good common sense. And we worked together in a locked ward and with very heartbreaking cases of adolescents that start to develop schizophrenia. And at some point, I said to her, "Hey, Bracha, you know what? I had enough of this psychiatry. I don't know what I'm doing. We're filling the brains of these young people with all these drugs. Nobody knows how these receptors work. People don't get better. I must say, I feel the urge to leave psychiatry and start a residency in cardiac surgery. At least I know what I'm doing there. You know, there is a blocked artery, you bypass it. And here, what do we know?" And she looked at me, actually, with this warm gaze, and she had this squeaky voice, and she said to me, "It's all true, Yoram, but tell me, is there something more fascinating than the human psyche?" And this sentence actually immediately put me back in the chair, because I knew she was right. And I don't stop being fascinated by the human psyche and be humbled by it and how it works and how it can heal itself when we give the psyche the right setting. And obviously psychiatry also confronts you with your limitations, with what you can do or cannot do, but it's an act of faith. Like Wilfred Bion said, analysis is an act of faith, and I think Jung would agree with him. Before we'll go into synchronicity, some quotes that I found very relevant to our talk today about humility. And you can see that synchronicity starts to emerge from these quotes. So Carl Gustav Jung, in the Red Book, in Liber Primus, in the chapter 5, that is entitled Experiences in the Desert, he says, "The one who learns to live with his incapacity has learned a great deal. This will lead us to the valuation of the smallest things and to wise limitations, which the greater heights demand." So this is very much about limitation and humilities, actually how it leads to wisdom. In the same Red Book, in chapter 2, entitled Soul and God, Jung writes, "Dreams pave the way for life and determine you without you understanding their language." You can feel humility hiding here, because in a way you're not the masters of your dreams. They in a way guide you and somehow to submit to their wisdom without fully understanding it. But who can teach and learn it, the language of dreams? Scholarliness alone is not enough. There is a knowledge of the heart that gives deeper insight. The knowledge of the heart is in no book, and it is not found in the mouth of any teacher, but grows out of you like the green seed from the dark earth. But how can I attain this knowledge of the heart? You can attain this knowledge only by living your life to the full. It appears as though you want to flee from yourself so as not to have to live what remains unlived until now. But you cannot flee from yourself. It is with you all the time and demands fulfillment. This is about individuation. If you pretend to be blind and dumb to this demand, you find being blind and deaf to yourself. This way you will never reach the knowledge of the heart. So actually, not being inflated with scholarliness and with intellectual knowledge, be connected to the fact that the knowledge of the heart that comes from experience, being involved in life, it gives you in order to understand the language of dreams. So I think it touches on synchronicity and on humility as well, as we will see shortly. The last quote, it's a bit long, but I think it's worth bearing with it, by Martin Buber, the Jewish philosopher, in his book called Jewish Mysticism and the Legends of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov was one of the founder of the Hasidic movement in Judaism, in Ukraine, actually. And it was about the knowledge of the heart, about what you feel when you pray, less about the scholarship. And this is what Martin Buber writes, and it's in a chapter in his book called Humility. Jewish saying, righteousness delivers from death. It is commanded that he who helps should not think of the others who could help him, of God or of man, and that he should not consider himself as part of a power, and as though he only had to contribute, but that each man should stand in integrity, answerable and responsible for himself. This is one thing more, and it is only another way of expressing the mystery of humility. To help, not out of pity, which arises from a sharp, quick pain, which one wishes to exercise, but out of love, which means to live with others. The man who merely pities does not live with the suffering of the sufferer. He does not carry it in his heart. To live with others, as if one should share the life of a tree in its sucking up the moisture and its putting forth of foliage and the dream of its roots and the desire of its trunk and the thousand movements of its boughs, or as if one should share in the life of an animal with all its movement and stretches and clawing and with all the joy of its sinews and limbs and the dumb understanding of its brain. So you'll have time later to dwell more into this quote. But what he's saying, I feel, is that if you try to help from pity, oh, I don't know, this patient is really miserable and I should help him, there is an element of power here. And Jung already said that the opposite of love is not hate, it's power. And when you are living with others, I think it's the Buber way to speak about compassion. Compassion means to suffer with. You are in this mystery of humility. And this is actually speaks about the heart, the language of the heart. And interestingly, he starts to go into the tree, into the animal. And as we'll see with synchronicity, synchronicity is actually the anima mundi, the spirit of the world. That the world has a psyche and everything is connected. There is a quote at the end of my talk. I'll jump forward. Marcus Aurelius said, everything is connected and the web is holy. So if you are in this state of humility and you really immerse yourself with others, I think synchronicity will happen more. It's just a theory that I came with in the last few years. I can back it up just by experience, but it's just an interesting and moving thing to find it. And actually, this book was on my shelf for nearly 5 years. I found it, I scanned it, I looked at different chapters, But just a week before, I said, let's open it and see if there is something on humility. And there is. Okay. So keep it in mind and we'll jump into synchronicity. So like I mentioned, synchronicity can be viewed as maybe the psyche of the world. And I'll start with the definition of Jung for synchronicity. And Jung says, I chose this term because the simultaneous occurrence of two meaningfully but not casually connected events seemed to me an essential criterion. So simultaneous occurrence of two meaningfully but not causally connected events. I am therefore using the general concept of synchronicity as the special sense of a coincidence in time of two or more casually unrelated events which have the same or a similar meaning. In contrast to synchronism, which simply means the simultaneous occurrence of two events. So, I don't know, you see a red bus and then you see another red bus. But unless subjectively it means a lot, most times, you know, this is what happens in London because most of the buses are red. But it doesn't have this meaning. And synchronicity therefore means the simultaneous occurrence of a certain psychic state with one or more external events, which appear as meaningful parallels to the momentary subjective state, and in certain cases, vice versa. And also Jung says later in a different place that synchronicity gives you a feeling of numinosity. So it's not just a meaningful coincidence with two events that seem not connected, but it also gives you this feeling. I asked George Wright, who was, I think, before he was a psychotherapist, a priest, and he's an SAP member, was my tutor. I was very lucky to have him. And I asked him, George, what do you do with synchronicity? And he said, it's less what you do with synchronicity. It's more what it does to you. So again, it's this humble position. Two personal stories that are connected to synchronicities with my late parents. My father died 10 years ago and my mother 5 years ago at a good age, 86 and 87, but it's always too early, obviously. And the story of the synchronicity regarding my father starting Lodz in Poland, where he was born and where he lived with his family. There were 9 children. Only him and his sister survived the Holocaust. So what happens, the Nazis go into Lodz, all the Jews are put in the ghetto, these are images from ghetto Lodz, across this bridge. And my father was told by his mother when he was 15, him and his brother Lova were the smallest children in this family, and she told them, take your bags and run now. And this is what my father did. And they managed to cross the border. And then they somehow managed to be in contact with the family in the ghetto. And they heard that the Nazis castrated the brother Moshe as part of the sadistic things that the Nazis used to do. And my uncle Lova decided he wants to join the Russian army and to fight the Nazis as a revenge. But sadly, his train was bombarded on the way to the front. And my father stayed alone in the world when he was 15. And my father started his journey from Lodz. So he crossed the border to Russia. And from Russia, he reached Stalingrad. And from Stalingrad, he took another train and reached Tashkent in Uzbekistan. And then he reaches the market in Tashkent. And what he does without thinking, he steals a bag of rice. And he told me, I didn't know why I did it, but I stole it. And then he said, I need to study something. I need to go into a school. I need a profession to survive. So he asked people, where's the best school? And they told him, there is this school that teaches metalworks and carpentry, and it's a boarding school, and it's very good. So my father went there and sat before the door of the head teacher and waited until the head teacher came out. And without thinking, he gave him this bag of rice and told him, please accept me to the school, and told him his story, that he's alone in the world, he wants to be productive, he wants a profession, he needs a roof above his head. And somehow intuitively, this bag of rice, my father knew that he will make use of it. And luckily, the head teacher accepted him. And he had this 5 years in Tashkent, and he said, I was good, I had friends, I learned my profession. And I had my first girlfriend, it was okay. And after the war, he goes back to Lodz and goes home. He said to me that when his mother waved goodbye to him and his brother, he wanted so much to cry, but he couldn't. He went into a survival mode and a sort of an emotional dissociation. But when he came to Poland and went home and knocked on the door, and strange people opened the door, because there were many empty houses in Lodz. Most of the Jews, all the Jews were exterminated, and the houses were free. And this was the moment where he knew that this is it, there's nobody there. And this is where he started to cry. And he started to cry, and he ran and cried, and then sat on a bench completely exhausted. And from nowhere, his friend from primary school, Arye Tischler, appears. And he says to him, Abrasha, Abraham, you're alive, Arye. And he said, yes. So Arye Tischler was a very dynamic man, and said, get up, we're going to recreate Gordonia. Gordonia was a youth movement that was based on the teaching of A.D. Gordon, who went to Israel when he was 45, to the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, a kibbutz, and he was a sort of a Jewish Tolstoy, and he spoke about the redemption of the psyche through working with the earth. A fascinating man that actually invented a word in Hebrew, and the word is called Chavaya. Chavaya in Hebrew is the essence. Chaim is life. And Aleph Dalet Gordon said, we need a new word to speak about an essence, about an essence that is alive. Yeah? And Chavaya is an experience. So when you are experiencing things, your essence becomes alive. And actually, synchronicity is an experience. It's an experience. It's a living thing. So, and this is in his essay, The Man and Nature. So anyhow, my father joined Gordonia. And just to say that about the experience, the Chavaya, this is Rudolf Otto, who wrote his book, The Holy, Das Heilig. When he speaks about the numinous experience, he says, what is the nature of the numinous? I feel it as something objective, but it is irrational, and you cannot explain it logically. You can only notice the unique emotional response it evokes in the psyche that experiences it. This is what happens in synchronicity. This is the Chavaya of the A.D. Gordon speaks about. So again, it's something objective. Synchronicity happens, but it is irrational. You cannot explain it logically, but you can notice the emotional response it evokes in the psyche that experiences it. This is what George Wright actually said to me when he said, it's what it does to you. Yeah. So my father comes to Israel, to a kibbutz, and he becomes a metal worker. He was very, very unique in his works. he was really an artist, but he also taught the kids that came from the Holocaust, and he worked as a teacher for 35 years, and he was very proud. He said, thousands of people have a profession because of what I gave them, so I did my thing. So this is the first part. So the next part of the story is when I start to start medicine in Be'er Sheva. It's a town in the south of Israel, in the Negev. Actually, it's a town that is very much related to Abraham. That was the, you know, this is my father's name, because the biblical Abraham came there and digged seven wells. This is why it's called Be'er Sheva, seven wells. And when he came to Israel on his individuation trip, and I studied the first year of medicine, and on the second year I didn't want to live in the dormitory. I wanted to find something more atmospheric. So I saw an advert that in the old town of Be'er Sheva, which is very old, and these old Arab houses, there is somebody who, in this street, Smilansky Road, somebody who rents a unit in his garden. And I come, and the man is very nice, and the garden is nice, and the atmosphere is really homely. It's cheap, it's close to the university. I said to him, I'm Yoram, I'm studying medicine. And he says, okay, Yoram, what's your surname? Jim, coming to your question. And I said, Inspector. He looks at me as if he's completely struck. He says, Inspector is your surname? I says, yes. And what's the name of your father? I said, Abraham. So he says, Abrasha Inspector is your father? I says, yes. And this was Aryeh Tischler, the man who actually, I didn't know about this story that I told you before, how my father ran away, how he cried when he came back. My father didn't tell me. I think he didn't want to upset me. They were very protective on us, not to re-traumatize us. But when I met Aryeh Tischler, and I came to my father and I said, you know, I met Aryeh Tischler, my father said, okay, now I can tell you the story. But what is the chance that I meet this man in Be'er Sheva, in this street, and this man will be so much connected to something so deep in my biography, history, will enable me to get this story for my father? I think you can feel the numinous feeling here, and what you do with it, I don't know what you can do with it, it's what it does to you. It humbles you. It gives you a feeling that there's something going on here that you cannot represent, but is working. And then what's really interesting, that when I wanted to, when I created this talk, part of it, I gave it to the Jung Club. I wanted to see if Aryeh Tischler is still alive. So I Googled Aryeh Tischler, and I found that he died in a good age, 93 or so. And then there is a picture. The man on the right here, and the bottom right, is Aryeh Tischler, yeah? Then you see this little kid, yeah, with a hand on his shoulder, and the man who holds the hand on his shoulder is my father. So again, I find the picture where they are both together, which I didn't know about, and I found it when I create this talk about synchronicity. The next personal synchronistic story is related to my mother. My mother was born in Trnava in Slovakia. It was called the Little Vatican because it had many, many churches. But it also had a Jewish community that also suffered tremendously and was exterminated. But now there is the synagogue is still there, and they pay a lot of attention to rehabilitate the Jewish culture there. This is my mother and her parents, in Slovakia. And I chose this quote from Goethe, who says, "We all have electrical and magnetic forces that act within us and between us, and they have an attractive or repulsive influence depending if we are in touch with someone or something similar or different." Because the story is that my mother was always very, very intuitive. I actually sit here and talk to you because of her intuition that is related to this story. At the beginning of the war, my grandfather was advised by his friend that then became a minister in the Slovak government to convert into Christianity, and they became Catholic. My mother told me about this funny moment where she had to confess in front of the priest. And she thought to herself, she said, "I didn't do anything wrong. What will I say to him?" And she was very anxious because of this confession. And she couldn't think about something wrong. And the last minute, suddenly it came. She was 15 and said, "I read Madame Bovary, you know, of Flaubert, obviously about adultery." And she was so relieved and said, "Thank God, you know, that you reminded me of this." And she said to the vicar, "Yeah, I read Madame Bovary." He said, "Oh, that's really bad, but I forgive you. No worries." So, but then it was too difficult, too dangerous. So they actually were saved by Slovak parents, a Catholic Slovak parents that risked their lives to save them. And my mother made sure that they will be, they have a tree, you know, in the place where Oskar Schindler has a tree in Jerusalem. And they were living there in the attic of their house for nearly 3 years. For 1 year of these 3 years, there were also two Nazis that took a room in the house. So they were living with the predator in the same house. And my grandfather here, that was a relentless optimist, said, "It will be all right. You study for your A-levels or baccalaureate, or it will be all right." And they used to be in the attic at night. And during the day, they went down. And they had to be deadly silent, obviously, during the night. And then one morning, my mother starts to cry when they are downstairs and said, "We need to go up immediately because they will come to drink water." And my grandfather says to her, "Oh, don't worry about it. It will be all right." And he said, no, we have to." And my mother starts to sob. And my grandfather said, "Okay, if you're so anxious, let's go up." And they went up. And after 5 minutes, the Nazis came and they heard one of them shouting to the other, "Heinz, I'm very thirsty. Where's the water?" And it didn't happen before or after. This saved my mother's life. And luckily, I didn't hear to all my mother's intuitions because she said, "I have a bad feeling about this school trip. You know, don't go." And I said, "I'm going. I cannot live like that, you know." But many times she was getting things right before it happened. And obviously, this intuition and this synchronicity between what she felt and what happened in the external world, you know, saved my life. But also, this is the mystery of synchronicity. And also, it humbles you because when you think everything will be all right, you know, sometimes you need to listen to intuitions that come from a different place. Interestingly, I shared this story with a Lacanian psychiatrist when I was training as a psychiatrist, and they tried to convert me to psychoanalysis and Lacanianism. And I was already involved in a Jungian training. And I told her this story, and she said to me, "You know, Yoram, you do not have to be a Jungian analyst just because this has happened to your mother." Yeah, because Jung still, among psycho analysts and some Jungians, his mother was a medium and, you know, obviously was accused by Freud of taking psychoanalysis to the mud of the occult. But Jung was a phenomenologist. He said, "These things happen. So why wouldn't I be interested in them?" And this is what Jung says. "As a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist, I often come up against the phenomenon in question, synchronicity, and could convince myself how much these inner experiences meant to my patients. In most cases, there were things which people do not talk about or fear of exposing themselves to thoughtless ridicule. I was amazed to see how many people have had experience of this kind and how carefully the secret was guarded. So my interest in this problem has a human as well as a scientific foundation. Jung writes about synchronicity together with Wolfgang Pauli. Wolfgang Pauli was at the beginning also Jung's patient, and he was the Nobel Prize winner for physics and a very interesting man. You can see a nice quote of him who was very witty. This isn't right. This isn't even wrong. You know, what do you make of that? And there is a principle, the Pauli principle in physics on the atom about him. And it's in a book called Interpretation of Nature and Psyche. A quote from Jung, I simply believe that some part of the human self or soul is not subject to the laws of space and time. And obviously when we speak how my mother knew in advance what's going to happen in a few minutes, it's in a different space and time. Another quote from Jung, the problem of synchronicity has puzzled me for a long time, ever since the middle 20s, when I was investigating the phenomena of the collective unconscious and kept on coming across connections which I simply could not explain as chance, groupings or runs. What I found were coincidences which were connected so meaningfully that the chance occurrence would be incredible. So again, it's incredible that I met this man that met my father on the bench in Poland. It's incredible what happened to my mother. And I'll share with you some more incredible stories in my clinical work. But first of all, two synchronicities that Jung mentioned that happened to himself. Jung was working in Bollingen in the tower that he built on Lake of Zurich on the principle, on the symbolic significance of the fish and the snake in alchemy. And he's writing that and he's reading about that. And then he goes out of his house and he sees a snake that swallowed the fish. Again, the synchronicity between his inner world and the outer world. And he was so impressed by it that he carved it on the stone in Bollingen. I think both the fish and the snake died. The fish was too big, but the synchronicity is incredible. Then in this book, he tells a story that maybe some of them know about the scarab. The scarab, the sacred scarab, embodies the Egyptian god Kefiri, who propels the sun out of the darkness of the underworld and across the sky in his diurnal journey. The dung beetle has the remarkable instinct of rolling balls of animal dung along the ground to its underground cache, where the dung will be stored for food. The scarab's relation to the rising sun made it an emblem of rebirth. So, Jung talks about, and this is a quote from the book, a young woman I was treating had at a critical moment a dream in which she was given a golden scarab. While she was telling me this dream, I sat with my back to the closed window. Suddenly I heard a noise behind me, like a gentle tapping. I turned round and saw a flying insect knocking against the window pane from outside. I opened the window and caught a creature in the air. As it flew in, it was the nearest analogy to the golden scarab that one finds in our latitudes, a scarabaeid beetle, the common rose chafer, Cetonia aurata, which contrary to its usual habits, has evidently felt an urge to get into the dark room at this particular moment. I must admit that nothing like it happened to me before or since, and that the dream of the patient has remained unique in my experience. There also seems to be an archetypal foundation to this case. It was an extraordinarily difficult case to treat, and up to the time of the dream, little or no progress has been made. So this woman that was, according to Jung, very thinking function, very intellectual, not related at all to this archetypal realm receives from her psyche this dream about a golden scarab that is given to her. And at the same moment that she tells the story, the scarab knocks on the window. Yeah? And actually amplifies this experience. So who does it? How it is connected? How the patient's psyche is connected to the scarab outside? I should explain, continues Jung, that the main reason for this was my patient animus, which was steeped in Cartesian philosophy and clung so rigidly to its own idea of reality that the efforts of three doctors, I was the third, had not been able to weaken it. Evidently, something quite irrational was needed, which was beyond my powers to produce. The dream alone was enough to disturb ever so slightly the rationalistic attitude of my patient. But when the scarab came flying in through the window, in actual fact, her natural being could burst through the armor of her animus possession, and the process of transformation could at least begin to move. Any essential change of attitude signifies a psychic renewal, which is usually accompanied by symbols of rebirth in the patient's dreams and fantasy. The scarab is a classic example of the rebirth symbol. The ancient Egyptian book of what is in the netherworld describes how the dead sun god changes himself at the 10th station into Kefiri, the scarab, and then at the 12th station mounts to Baraj, which carries the rejuvenated sun god into the morning sky. The only difficulty here is that with educated people, cryptomnesia often cannot be ruled out with certainty. Although my patient did not happen to know this symbol. So cryptomnesia is that you know the symbol already and then you re-experience it. It does not alter the fact that the psychologist is continually coming up against cases where the emergence of symbolic parallels cannot be explained without the hypothesis of the collective unconscious. Meaningful coincidences, which are to be distinguished from the meaningless chance grouping, therefore, seem to rest on an archetypal foundation. At least all cases, my experience, and there is a large number of them which show this characteristic. So Jung speaks about synchronicity related to the archetypal realm. I just mentioned this. He mentioned it in his book, a patient of him that had chest pain after he finished his analysis, or was at the end of the analysis, and Jung thought that something's wrong with his heart, that it's not psychosomatic. And he told this man, go and check your heart with a cardiologist. The man went to the cardiologist and came back with a certificate that he's okay. But on the way, he died from a sudden cardiac arrest. His wife then told Jung that she already knew that something wrong happened because these birds came as a flock, you say, or a group of birds came and landed on the tree. And this is what happened when her mother died and her grandmother died. So she knew that somebody died. How the birds knew, how the birds are connected to it, you know, this is the realm of synchronicity. These are actually two books, my experience. I was in analysis in Israel with Dvor Kuczynski. Dvor Kuczynski, she still works, she's 94. And when she was asked, and she survived Auschwitz, and she was analyzed by Erich Neumann. And she was now asked, Dvorah, for how long will you continue to work? And she said, at least 2.5 years after my death, I think. You know. So when I was in analysis with her, she told me, you need to get these two books of Neumann. One is a Depth Psychology and New Ethics, and the other one is Crisis and Renewal. So I go out of my session, and she said, but these books are completely out of print. So I go from her consulting room in Tel Aviv, and I go in Evin Viron Street, and there is an old bookshop. And I said, maybe they have it. I go there, and they have it in the shop window. You know, that's Ecology and New Ethics in the shop window. And it's written, you cannot read it in Hebrew. It says, out of print. The next week, I go out of my consulting room and said, maybe they have a crisis of renewal. I go there, and it's in the shop window as well. I never saw it before or after. So Erich Neumann himself, that speaks in crisis and renewal in this book that I found in a synchronistic way. He says, in a conversation about modern physics, that it is clear to every physicist nowadays that the theory that wants to describe reality will be more scientific if it will be more mystic. This shows how the natural sciences became more distant from the old idea of pure rationality. The term mystic does not mean something vague, blurry, or unclear. It relates to the fact that our knowledge about the world is such that when we try to grasp, understand this reality as a unitary reality, we arrive at the end in all domains to paradoxical statements. The reality is beyond our understanding and perception, which is suitable to grasp only fractions of it. And you can feel how humility echoes with this statement of Neumann. So you really cannot grasp it, just fractions of it. And actually that it's not mystic, it's happened. This is happening. Jung, in a letter to Erich Neumann on the process of creation: in all this chaos of opportunities and new combination, many synchronistic phenomena probably have happened that acted with and against the forces of nature in order to create archetypal moments, forms of synthesis that look to us miraculous. This demands a pre-assumption that not only there is a hidden continuous meaning, but also that the process of this pre-conscious time, a psychoid process, happens with which simultaneously at the same time and in a meaningful way, a physical event happens. At this stage, it is impossible to identify the meaning because unconsciousness was not born yet. I highlighted the term psychoid because this is a very important concept of Jung, and he speaks about the psychoid. And he says, here I only point out that it is the decisive factors in the unconscious psyche, the archetypes, which constitute the structure of the collective unconscious. The latter represents a psyche that is identical with itself in all individuals. It cannot be directly perceived or represented. In contrast to the perceptible psyche phenomena, and on account of it, non-representable nature, I've called it psychoid. So the psychoid is a part of the collective unconscious that is not representable. You cannot grasp it. How can I grasp what happened with my father, with my mother, with the scarab? It's on a level that Jung calls the psychoid, where psyche and matter are one, and we cannot grasp it, we cannot represent it. Just to consolidate this point, this is a wonderful paper for me that George Bright, that I mentioned him before, wrote in the Journal of Analytical Psychology. Here is the reference, 1997. He speaks about synchronicity as the basis of analytic attitude. George says that synchronicity is at the core of our analytical attitude. Interestingly, he opens the paper with a quote of Winnicott. A baby kicks in the womb. It cannot be assumed he is trying to kick his way out. A baby of a few weeks thrashes with his arms. It cannot be assumed he means to hit. A baby chews the nipple with his gums. It cannot be assumed that he is meaning to destroy or to hurt. This is a Nigelet Klein, obviously. But he says the baby is on the psychoid level. We have all sorts of theory, but what do we know what happens there? Yeah. And then he says, synchronicity, according to Jung, is not a philosophical view, but an empirical concept which postulates an intellectually necessary principle. It postulates a meaning which is a priori to human consciousness and apparently exists outside man. So there is this meaning outside my consciousness. I don't know, this meaning that made me meet this man, the friend of my father, a meaning that is beyond what happened with my mother and the Nazis, the scarab, and I'll follow with a few more examples. Jungtan Sacred is his way of referring to the latent and unconscious meaning which exists in all matter, not just in the human psyche. So the birds, the scarab, and still less in the conscious mind. Or even though the contents of the psychoid are unconscious, it is, as Jung says, an intellectually necessary concept to prevent the imputing of magical causality. Absolute or objective meaning is seen by Jung as uniquely the property of the psychoid, and he defines the psychoid as unconscious and unknowable. So again, what George Bright says, in other words, by introducing the concept of objective and unconscious meaning, the psychoid, Jung enables us to be explicitly clear that any conscious attribution of meaning, such as analytic interpretation, must be seen as subjective and provisional. It is work in progress, not a glimpse of absolute truth. And this is why synchronicity is connected to humility. Because, again, if the objective psyche, the processes that happens between us and our patients, are also on that level, and something happens there that is not representable, is beyond us, it's the meaning of psyche and soma, everything we say, it's not the absolute truth. The absolute truth happens on the psychic level. What we say is a suggestion, is a work in progress. And we know how much we argue between all our churches of psychotherapy, who has the truth. And this approach and accepting synchronicity in the psychoids can help in humbling us. So now a few stories from my clinical practice. Again, in the bracha, in the psychiatric world of Bracha Geoni that I mentioned before, I'm a young psychiatrist, and there is a young woman that was post-traumatized, and she also regresses into psychotic states, and she shouts and she hears voices, but she sits at the nursing station, and I need to stand up. I don't know if you see me, and she holds her hand here at the back, and she cries. It's so, so painful, so, so painful. I know very well this pain because I, at the age of 15, it was discovered that I suffered from this uretropelvic junction stenosis. So there was a stenosis between the kidney and the ureter. And then they did an operation, they opened it up and took the kidney stones, but I still remember the horrible pain of the kidney stones. And the kidney became bigger and the flow is slower, so every 10 years I produce a stone, and so on. So I know this pain very well. But at that time I looked at her and I said, this is a kidney stone. And they said to me, oh, don't, what are you talking about? You know, it's attention seeking and so on. And I said, no, I want her to do an ultrasound. She said, you're crazy. I said, no, we're going to have an ultrasound. I'm her doctor. So I took her, we did the ultrasound, and she had exactly what I had, a uretropelvic junction stenosis. And when I was wheeled to the operation table, I asked the surgeon, can you explain to me again what you're going to do? And the surgeon says, oh, I don't have time. And I still remember the anxiety that they're going to do something that they didn't tell me about or something like that. And this girl was psychotic, but I asked her because of my experience, do you want me to explain to you what they're going to do? And she said, yes, please. And I drew her the kidney and I drew her the narrow ureter. And I said, they're going to do that and they're going to open it. And she was completely well in the general hospital, went through the operation without any problems, without any psychotic. What is the chance that I'll meet this girl I was the best person to be there because I knew that. And also, she had exactly what I had. So these are moments where you feel that you've been sent there. That, I don't know, that there is some guardian angel, there is some that sent you there, not because I was the best doctor, but I was the best person because I knew this pain. Another story. A patient comes to the A&E, middle of the night, and she suffers from a severe obsessive-compulsive disorder. And she washes her hands constantly. And she wants to be admitted to the hospital. And I say, I don't think you need to be admitted to the hospital because of obsessive-compulsive disorder. The A&E is full with very difficult patients, the psychiatric A&E. I'll see you tomorrow in the outpatient clinic. And she says to me, okay, very sadly. I said, I'll see you tomorrow at 12 o'clock, lunchtime, come. I have an outpatient clinic. I'll see you, don't worry. And she doesn't come. She doesn't come. She doesn't come. She doesn't come. And then I send her a letter. She disappears. 3 months later, I'm called to the A&E, the general hospital, and the medical doctor says, there is a patient here. She says that she has pain all over her body. She has OCD. I'm discharging her. But I want you to assess her. So I go inside, I open the cubicle, and there she is, this woman that came to the A&E, that disappeared. I see her. And she looked very ill. The most important thing in medicine is, look at the patient, do they look ill? She looked very ill and very pale, and she had pain. Her husband said to me, you need to help us because she doesn't allow the children to step on the floor. We need to raise them because of the OCD. And I ask her, where is the pain? She says, all over my body, but mainly in my two shoulders. I heard that, and she was pain. I remember what happened to my mother. My mother had an ectopic pregnancy. She told me this story, and she bled into the abdomen. And when you bleed into the abdomen, the referred pain goes to the shoulders. So pain in the shoulders can be sometimes a result of bleeding into the abdomen. So suddenly I see her, she's pale, she's suffering. I said, maybe she's bleeding. So I said to the medical doctor, I want to take a blood count. And he said, oh, don't take a blood count, you know, I'm the doctor, because the joke in medical school is that the surgeon knows everything and does nothing. The medical doctor knows everything and does nothing. And psychiatrists, they do nothing and know nothing. So I said, I studied medicine, I'm taking the blood count. The hemoglobin was 9, should be 14. So I called the surgeon. The surgeon says, there isn't anything major. We don't have a bed. We'll see her tomorrow. And I had a feeling that she's bleeding. I couldn't tell her that. I didn't want to discharge her. And I said, do you want to spend the night in the psychiatric A&E? It's 10 minutes away from here. At least you'll be at home under our supervision. You won't go home. Said, yes, thank you. And I wrote to my colleague, please monitor vital signs. I think this woman is bleeding. Then after 3 hours, she's turfed back to us to the general A&E. Hemoglobin is 5. They rushed her to the theater. It was a rupture of the spleen. And the spleen has a capsule. It bleeds to the capsule. But this is where I saw it. But then the capsule breaks and you bleed into the abdomen. So actually, my intervention and my cautiousness and thinking about this bleeding because of the shoulders, because I had the medical knowledge, but also the story of my mother, saved this patient's life. And then I asked her, after she was saved, they took the spleen out, what happened? Because the question is, why the spleen burst? Yeah. And then we found out that the husband was an abusive husband. He kicked her in the stomach. And this is caused the rupture of the spleen. And when we took the husband through the social services out of the house, the obsessive compulsive disorder disappeared. So again, I was struck by this feeling that I was sent by some guardian angel to be there. I was the best person to be there because I saw her before. So I knew how well she was, and I immediately knew that she's ill, and I had all the information. So again, this synchronicity that at 3 o'clock at night in the A&E, I'm the person that is being called. So this story, which I'll end with the other clinical story. This is a patient of mine that had a severe panic disorder with agoraphobia. She was afraid to go out. In her childhood, her brother used to lock her in cupboards. This is why she was so claustrophobic. There was a whole story. And she was really afraid to go out. We did a sort of quite a straightforward CBT medication treatment that helped her to go out and so on. And we worked on a lot of things, her dreams, and she became much better. But she never went out of Israel, never. And her dream was to be in Paris. And during that time, the third year of the therapy, her husband participates in a ballot in his IT company, 300 people. And the price in a ballot, the price is 2 weeks in a 5-star hotel in the Champs-Élysées in Paris. He wins it. I was struck by it. And I said, this is it. You have to go. I said, I cannot go. I'll become mad on the plane. I said, how mad will you come on the plane? He says, I'll undress myself. I said, don't worry about it. The stewardess will say, madam, please put your clothes on. And so I'll try to open the door of the plane. I said, you cannot do it. It's locked. I'll become psychotic. I said, don't worry about it. We can treat it. I know how to treat psychosis. I will sue you if something will happen. I said, sue me. You go. And you take Xanax, you know, to reduce the anxiety. You hold the hand of your husband and you read the guide for Paris and you think about the best place you'll visit and the art museums. And in 4.5 hours, you're in Paris. What gave me the ultimate confidence to do that? It was a dream. She had a recurrent dream of a fifth room in her house that is blocked with cement for years. At that time, when her husband won the ballot, the dream changed. And she goes through this wall like through butter, and she sees the fifth room. And the fifth room is big, big windows, sunshine coming in. Into the room. So symbolically, a new place in the psyche opens up. And the synchronicity between this dream and him winning the ballot, I think we need to go with it. We need to accept this message. And now is the there is another problem because she cannot stop flying now. So I don't know if her husband likes it or not. But it opens up. And actually, psychotherapy is about widening the repertoire by which we relate to ourselves and to others. And synchronicity opens up this repertoire. So just to finish with these two quotes about what Erich Neumann says in Crisis and Renewal in the chapter called Embracement as the Basis to a New Experience. The humility, again, we're coming back from synchronicity to humility, in which we remember again and again how little we know about man, ourselves, a humility which has been acquired through sadness and despair, is, in my view, one of the basic values assets of depth psychology. The psyche is mostly unconscious and therefore mostly unknown. More than that, the psyche is both the subject, which inquires at the same time the object of its inquiry, because only via the psyche we can know the psyche and can say something about her. But he who wants to deny, because of this fact, from the depths to say something about the nature of man and his life, needs to remember that stating absolute truth, no matter whatever the basis to them is, are an act of arrogance and hubris. So hopefully you have more time to dwell into this quote, which is all about humility. Again, Marcus Aurelius, everything is connected and the web is holy. Just to say, to finish with, this was actually Tommy Cooper that died on stage. And what a synchronicity, you know, for a man like that to die while he's acting, you know. But Jung in the Red Book meets Philemon, who is the magician, and he's also a healer. And Jung asks him, "How did you heal all these people that you helped?" And Philemon says to him, with a lot of sympathy and a bit of magic, basically. And then Jung tries to get from him what is magic. And Philemon, in so many words, says to him, "I cannot explain magic to you, because if I could have explained magic, it would be a trick." Yeah. And I think synchronicity is related to magic, not in a tricky way, because you cannot reproduce it. And it also makes us humble, the things we cannot understand. And the definition of magic, and this is the definition of Jung in the Red Book for magic: the practice of magic consists in making what is not understood understandable in an incomprehensible manner. So I hope through this talk I gave you this feeling that I try to explain it, but it's still not comprehensive fully. The magical way is not arbitrary, since that would be understandable, but it arises from incomprehensible grounds. Besides, to speak of grounds is incorrect, since grounds concur with reason. Nor can one speak of the groundless, since hardly anything further can be said about it. The magical way arises by itself. If one opens up cows, magic also arises. So in therapy, we open cows, hopefully. One can teach the way that leads to cows, but one cannot teach magic. One can only remain silent about it. Again, humility, which seems to be the best apprenticeship. This view is confusing, but this is what magic is.